chapter 11, section 1. And kind of the big idea here is that a democratic society requires active participation of its citizens. Once more, my sales pitch that this class is designed to promote active participation of American citizens in the electorate. We need that as a people to survive. Well, a few things that we're going to look at. We'll talk about public opinion, mass media, interest groups, how to gauge public opinion through polling, and then finally, what you can do as a summer job is maybe be a pollster, someone who gathers this type of information for a living. So, should politicians be able to ignore public opinion and do what they think is best for the country? This is a question that we always face as part of a republic. Since we elect people to represent us, instead of voting for every decision ourselves, they do retain the right to vote against the interest of the people who elected them. And so first off, thinking about public opinion, what does that even mean? You know, it's the ideas and attitudes that most people hold. It can be difficult to gauge, and people do this as a full-time job. Do nothing but try to gauge what the public opinion on a various issue is. And knowing what the public opinion is actually a vital part of our democracy. So, public opinion means the ideas and attitudes that most people hold about elected officials, about candidates, our government, or even political issues. You know, for example, one study claimed that 97% of Americans support some type of background check for the purchase of a firearm. And that's a form of public opinion. That is something that pollsters, professionals who gather information about public opinion have determined that this is something that the American people want. It is an extremely important part of our democracy. What the people want is a way that lawmakers gauge what they should do. Now, our president is the only person who has to be elected by the nation as a whole. And in order for them to get things done, they need the support of the American people. They also need the support of Congress to get anything done. So if everyone hates the president, then they are unlikely to get much accomplished during their tenure. And so lots of money is spent to gauge what the public want. This helps presidents time their decisions. You know, for example, laws regulating the use of assault weapons have been a part of the national discussion for decades. But perhaps the recent crises have made the time favorable to moving these discussions forward. And so timing is a big deal in terms of public opinion. How do we find out this information? First off, we have to think about who are answering these questions. And so if you ever do get called by a pollster, which you very well might, then they're going to first ask you about your background. How old are you? Are you male or female? How much money do you make? What race do you identify as? What religion, if any, do you practice? What do you do for a living? Where do you live? And all of these questions might feel very personal, and they are. But they are necessary for figuring out who you are and why you're answering these questions in the way that you are. Because what pollsters have found is that who you are says a lot about how you will answer political questions. Another source of important public opinion is mass media. Mass media is a mechanism of mass communication. This includes everything from TV to newspapers to magazines to the internet to the movies to books to audio. Anything that is designed to reach a large audience can be lumped into mass media. Public officials are also a source of public opinion. They do this for a living. You know, one thing that these representatives are hoping to achieve by coming and talking to you guys is they really do want to find out how you feel about certain issues. They really do. It might or might not affect their decisions, but part of their job is figuring out who you are and what you want. And then lastly, interest groups. Interest groups are very important, and they are a part of our lives as citizens. You may find an interest group that is working for something that you like. You know, there is an interest group devoted to lobbying on the behalf of those who ride motorcycles. There's an interest group for gamers. There's an interest group for folks who love to read. There's an interest group for most everything you can think of. And these interest groups are people who share common points of view about issues, and they unite to promote those beliefs. Because here's the reality. If you go to Raleigh and you stand outside the governor's mansion and you knock on his door and you say, "Governor Cooper, I'd like to see this law changed." Well, he's going to look from his balcony or on the security cameras and he's going to see you out there. He's just going to call security and you'll have to leave. You know, that's not how you get things done. You don't just march up to the door by yourself and say, "Change this law or else." That's considered assault, or at the very least, trespassing. If you want to get things done, you need to get a lot of other people involved. And that's where we can get things done. Okay, so what types of public opinion do we see? What can come as a result of how people feel about a certain issue? Number one, this can change the direction of a political movement. So let's say that the movement is leading us to implement self-driving vehicles. Let's say we're headed that direction, which we probably are, right? Maybe in the next 5 or 10 years, self-driving vehicles will be available for consumer purchase. Well, let's say they go crazy and start driving into buildings and running over pedestrians. And before you know it, there's just this crazy mass killing of robot cars, and it becomes unsafe to step outside your home. I'm assuming that's going to move public opinion away from self-driving cars, right? It wouldn't take too many cars running over pedestrians to move public opinion away from that.
Have the cars developed a mind of their own?
Yeah, it's like, oh my gosh, the robot apocalypse, here we go. So direction of public opinion, certainly. Even the intensity of public opinion, you know, that's something we try to gauge. Okay, people want this. Well, to what degree do they want this? Are they, you know, storming the palaces with pitchforks, or are they filling out surveys on Facebook? You know, to what degree are people angry about this certain thing? And then finally, stability. You know, we need to know, is this public opinion a fad, or is it going to be around for a while? Is this what the people really want? And we have to gauge that from a large number of people, because after all, we are fickle. To mass media. You know, the question is, how much influence does this have? And that can sometimes be a difficult question to gauge. How much, to what degree are we influenced by the media that we consume? So the next part is, how do we figure this out? How do we figure out what you guys want? Well, the simplest way is with a poll. With a small group, I can just talk to you, and I can figure out, you know, do you guys hate this way of doing things? Would you prefer a different way? And we can gauge that very easily in a small group. But in a large group, well, surveys are probably the most effective way. And so that's where we wind up with public opinion polls. And a public opinion poll is really just a survey. in which individuals are asked to answer questions about a particular issue or person. And I can tell you how a poll is written has a big influence on how those questions will be answered. You know, for example, if you were asked the question, you hate this person, right? Right? That's going to influence you to answer that question in a certain way versus, how do you feel about this question, yes or no? Secondly, election results are perhaps the most accurate public opinion poll there is. Because after all, these polls, and pollsters do this for a living, they really try to gauge opinion by surveying people of different backgrounds. But they're still only dealing with a small, small group of people. And election results, at least, are the largest group of people that we're likely to get to answer any kind of questions on a given subject. And then finally, a pollster. A pollster is someone who does this for a living. Let's say you decide to study psychology or you go into political science. One of the easiest jobs to get in those fields are creating surveys and collecting them. It's not glamorous, but it's a necessary part of a functioning democracy, is to figure out what the heck you guys want. Okay, so how do we do this? How do we collect information? Well, first off, we can't just only ask white people. We can't, because there are certain things that white people are going to say that other minority groups might not. So we've got to ask people of all different backgrounds and races. This is called a random sample. Random sample. Because after all, if we just ask white males between 18 and 23, well, that's going to give us a very limited set of answers. So random sampling. Secondly, a well-constructed sample needs to represent the entire population. We've got to have men, we've got to have women, we've got to have people who identify as transgender, we've got to have anything you can think of. We've got to have people of different races, of different backgrounds, of religions, etc. And again, that would lead to, in theory, a well-constructed sample. And then finally, we've got to word these questions very carefully, because once more, if you say, you hate this idea, right? That's going to lead the questioner. We can't do that. We have to ask very open-ended, very carefully constructed questions. And then finally, the opposite of that is a push poll. You hate this idea, right? That's called a push poll. A survey designed to elicit a certain response. So, now, there are arguments for and against polling. Number one, polling allows office holders to keep in touch with citizens' ideas. So, our representatives, Congressman Meadows and General Assembly Congressman Henson, want to meet everyone they represent. They would love to have the time to be able to have a personal conversation with every one of you, but they just simply don't. There's not enough time in the day for them to meet every one of their constituents throughout their term. They can meet many of them, and they really have to do that as part of their job, but they also have to figure out what you guys want. And one way to do this is polling. Now, the idea is that it is meant to make officials more concerned with what you guys want, but it can also backfire. It can wind up making officials more concerned with what you guys want than actually making decisions for your benefit, because sometimes we don't always want the smart thing. And that's why we elect professionals to sometimes make important decisions for us. So critics of polls worry that these types of things can distort elections. You know, for example, you guys raised a legitimate concern when we were talking about presidential elections that you may not want to vote for the third party candidate because they don't have a chance of winning, ergo it's a wasted vote. Well, you're basing that information off of polls. You know, polls suggest that Gary Johnson would only win 1% of the popular vote. So nobody's going to show up and vote for him. So critics do worry that polls can harm the political process. They also worry that they can affect voter turnout. You know, what if you thought that Hillary Clinton's election as president was a foregone conclusion based on polls? All the polls suggested that she was going to win. And so what if you just said, I'm not going to bother. It's already a foregone conclusion. So I'm not going to bother voting. And what if enough people did that to sway the results? So in that case, polls affected possibly the outcome of a national election. And that's obviously a concern about polls. If they suggest something is inevitable, then we will not get involved as a result. So, of course, the question about push polls is controversial, because some people do want to use push polls to manipulate results. Section 2, and it's called the mass media. And so the big idea is, where do we get our information? How does this information shape what we think about particular issues? And so the examples of print media, electronic. Also, we'll be talking about a few legal terms in relation to what we can do with free speech and what we cannot. And we'll also be even thinking about how speech can be harmful. And so the first question I want to ask, do you think that the media's need to make a profit causes them to misrepresent some issues? Like it or not, we're getting our information from those who are paid to provide us with information. It is in their best interest to get the highest ratings or the most clicks and likes, and so they must curate their information in a certain way so that we will choose to consume it, because after all, that's how they make their money. And unfortunately, this can have a negative impact. Think about the importance and impact of our nation's media. The media is extremely influential on politics, and I hope to provide some examples with that. And the government also sets and helps set the public agenda with reacting often to what they're seeing in the media. And so the mass media has a profound influence, not only on us, the electorate, but even on elected officials. And it connects people in a way that perhaps never before have we been connected with our public officials. All of these folks that we've invited, all of our representatives, I follow them on social media, and so I see what they post on a daily basis. And that gives me a very realistic and current view on what they're doing. So examples of the media that we consume. The oldest would be print media. Print media are any types of information that we consume that are in the printed form. For example, newspapers, magazines, newsletters, brochures, even books fall into print media. Perhaps the more common that we consume on the regular is electronic media. Obviously, the internet might be the most common that we utilize today, though radio is still relevant as we drive to and fro to school or work, but also even still television. But again, increasingly, many of us get our information and news from the internet. And so what we have to realize when we are consuming professional information is that someone is making that information accessible to you and they're getting paid to do it. And they have a profit incentive to keep you engaged. And so it's why you don't often hear news about everything being happy in the world today. because no one clicks on that. No one bothers. They want to hear the juicy stuff. And so the media has a profound influence on the public agenda. And by public agenda, I mean these issues that are considered most significant by the public and by government officials. So when we hear about a problem in the media, and if it's something that is relevant to us and something that we are engaged and interested in, whatever it may be, then we are more easily than ever able to before, we are able to express our concerns publicly. And the more people that express those concerns publicly, it can become a trending issue on any form of social media. When an issue becomes trending, then politicians are listening. And that will often prompt government officials into action. Political candidates are especially sensitive to what's trending in the media and with popular public opinion. And they'll watch for what these trending issues are, and they will use that knowledge to write their speeches because they want to make sure they are speaking to issues that are relevant and concerning and real to each of us. And so once again, that's how you get Ted Cruz cooking bacon with a machine gun. So politicians are aware of who journalists are, often are on a first-name basis. And journalists are one of the important safeguards of our democracy. They keep the public aware of important events going on. Often the government will leak information to the media purposefully to gauge to see how it will play. A leak is a release of a secret government document by an anonymous source, usually from government officials, usually to a news media outlet. For example, the Pentagon Papers, which revealed that the United States had plans to go into Vietnam even before the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Those papers were released in 1975. They were very damaging to the administration at that time. And things like that get leaked all the time. So leaks can be purposeful. They can also be perpetrated by disgruntled employees to damage someone's character or reputation. But oftentimes they are used to test the public reaction to an idea. Or even to manipulate the public opinion to gain favor for an idea. If they can get ahead of a story, they can control the narrative of the story as it's unfolding. Even though the media can be manipulated, and even though we can easily be manipulated, the media still serves its important watchdog purpose. It still makes us aware of corruption and still gives us a way to hold our politicians accountable for wrongdoings. But often the question is raised about the concerns of national security against the public's need to know something. You know, for example, recently documents related to the Kennedy assassination have been released as part of the Freedom of Information Act. Some of those documents are still being scrutinized to determine whether or not they can be released to see if they will affect national security in any way. We have a right to know what happened, but still we can't assume that we should know everything because it might harm agents in the field. And so the press are often invited to witness important events, but they are often required to withhold information from the public for purposes of security. And so leaks, again, can serve various purposes. They can be of great benefit to journalists. Sometimes they are intended to damage a person's reputation. And then, of course, sometimes they are used to test how an idea will fly. Okay, so the media is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The government protects the ability of the mass media to operate freely. And so in the First Amendment, it guarantees freedom of the press from some particular things. For example, freedom from prior restraint. This is a term we saw yesterday. Prior restraint means censorship of materials before they are published. You know, censorship. You know, regardless of the Mueller investigation's results, we will be aware of them, and the president can do nothing to stop that, because he cannot exercise prior restraint. He cannot censor that information. There are limits, however. There are real limits to the freedom of press. For example, libel. Libel is a written untruth that is harmful to someone's reputation. The press have an obligation to present the facts, because if they tell an untruth, and that untruth is harmful to someone's reputation, they can be brought to court for it. It's a crime called libel. In fact, the United States Supreme Court ruled that public officials must prove actual malice. Malice means evil intent by the publisher. So you can't commit libel accidentally, according to the United States Supreme Court. You have to try. You have to mean to harm someone with what you are writing in order for it to be considered libel. Media has the right to keep its sources secret. In fact, the Federal Communications Commission is a regulatory commission that exists for the purposes of ensuring that our freedom of speech is protected and that airways are kept a safe place for free speech to be expressed. In fact, this was the same group that was regulating net neutrality until recently. Lastly, the question is, should the FCC have increased powers to censor content of television broadcasts, regardless of your opinions? That has recently happened with the repeal of net neutrality, and I guess we'll see what happens. Talking about Chapter 11, Section 3, and the big idea behind this is that political and economic institutions evolve to help individuals and groups accomplish their goals. So the idea of our Republic is that our government should be responsive to its voters. But how does that work in practice? Some of the ideas that we'll be looking at today are public interest groups, public or political action committees. What does it truly mean to be nonpartisan, if that's even possible? And then what is a lobbyist? So, we've already discussed that groups with great financial resources can exercise powerful influence, even sometimes pushing out the interest of those with fewer resources. But an interest group is an important part, nonetheless, of our political process, because they, after all, influence policy. You see, an interest group is an organization of people who unite to promote their ideas. If there is something in this world you want to change, the reality is you won't be able to change it yourself. The comfort is there's probably an interest group working to promote that very change that you want to see. And so in a way, they play a vital role. There are various types of interest groups. We'll start with the economic ones. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is an interest group devoted to protecting and promoting free enterprise. If you've ever heard of Big Tobacco, the Tobacco Institute represents all cigarette and tobacco manufacturers in our country. They are a very powerful lobby working to make sure that cigarettes remain legal and they remain available in stores for you to purchase. Another great example of this is the AFL-CIO. It stands for the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. This is an economic interest group. In fact, it is the largest labor union in our country. And its goal is to promote the financial well-being and economic interest of its workers. Once more, the AFL-CIO. Another example of an economic interest group is the American Medical Association. This group represents doctors. They provide malpractice insurance. They release statements about new drugs. They authorize what the Federal Drug Administration has deemed safe for consumption. They are the authoritative definition on drugs and procedures in this country. And you can read their official statement on all manner of procedures and new drugs coming out. Other types of interest groups. The NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, is certainly an interest group. They were founded in 1909 by W.E.B. Du Bois, and their goal has been to promote civil rights for African Americans and to protect civil rights for African Americans. And they've been working ever since for that. There's the National Organization of Women. They represent women's interest. You know, they have been working to not only help secure voting rights for women in our country, but to promote the financial well-being and to help women be protected from discrimination. There is the American Association of Retired Persons. It's the old people interest group. That is a thing. And they work for promoting the interest of the elderly. Or maybe if you're an outdoors person, the Sierra Club is an interest group devoted to protecting and conserving our nation's natural resources. And, of course, the National Rifle Association is an interest group. And they have been working to protect Americans' gun ownership rights and have lately been fighting against the possible ban on assault weapons. So a public interest group. A public interest group is an organization that supports causes that affect the lives of Americans in general. For example, the League of Women Voters. They are a nonpartisan group. Nonpartisan means that they are free from party ties or bias. And their goal is to promote voter participation. There's a Henderson County League of Women Voters. They are an excellent resource in terms of voter education and increasing voter participation. I'll try to get them in here sometime to talk to you guys. There are also interest groups that support particular candidates. These are called political action committees. A political action committee is a political organization established by a corporation, a labor union, or another type of special interest group designed to support candidates by contributing money. So once again, political action committees are very powerful interest groups. They devote financial resources to particular candidates. Interest groups even bring cases to court. I have a friend who is a lawyer in Greenville. He's an environmental lawyer. And he recently challenged a case in court on behalf of American Whitewater, an environmental interest group. A local family in South Carolina was trying to tell people they could not legally float on a river that goes by their property. They tried to say off limits. Well, in North Carolina and South Carolina, there is a freedom of waterways law, meaning that if it is a navigable waterway, you can float down that river no matter what, even if private property is on either side. As long as you stay in the river, you can legally float down it. And so they had to demonstrate in front of the judge that the river could be safely navigated. And so they showed a video of the people going down the rapids, case closed. It can be navigated safely. The person had no claim to tell these folks they could not go onto their property because it's not technically their property. It's a navigable waterway. And so that lawyer was paid for by American Whitewater, who I helped pay part, a very small part, of their operating costs. So interest groups also attempt to influence lawmakers using lobbyists. And so I follow this one individual who is a lobbyist for an interest group called the Outdoor Alliance. Like the Sierra Club, this group works to promote access to America's beautiful places and also to protect those beautiful places from development. He is a lobbyist. A lobbyist is someone who is a representative of an interest group. It is that person's job to contact lawmakers or other government officials directly and to attempt to influence their policymaking decisions. So this person has a very good understanding of how the government functions. They also know which government department to contact. For example, Outdoor Alliance is in very close contact with the Department of the Interior. That is the executive level cabinet department whose job it is to protect our natural resources. And then finally, they supply lawmakers with useful information. You know, one of the most recent fights between the Outdoor Alliance and the Department of the Interior has been over the federal protection of particular public lands in Utah, a particular place called the Bear's Ear National Monument. And the Department of Interior, who's currently led by a cabinet level position whose last name is Zinke, Zinke wanted to declare those federally protected lands part of the state of Utah's public lands. So he wanted to turn them over from the federal government to the state. And then Utah had plans to drill and mine on those particular lands. So bottom line, if those lands are to remain protected, they must keep their federally protected status. And so this young man, who's a lobbyist for Outdoor Alliance, has gone and met with members of the Department of Interior on a regular basis. He's always in Washington trying to convince these people, however possible, to keep those lands federally protected. Because otherwise, they'll just be a big mine or a big something there. And that's what that person does for a living. And that's actually a rather lucrative career that you can go into if your passion is law or politics. And so they suggest solutions. You know, is there a better way to do this that doesn't have to result in the destruction of Bear's Ear National Monument. And it's certainly a problem that a lot of people feel needs to be addressed. Groups like the Outdoor Alliance even have versions of their own laws they can try to suggest. You know, the NRA has their own versions of laws to prevent threats to gun ownership. And obviously they don't have the power to pass these laws, but they suggest them. You know, hey, here's a new idea for this. We've already written it out. Have your lawyers check it. Lobbyists testify in legislative hearings on bills, because the reality is that our lawmakers aren't fully aware of all matters, and so they are going to need experts' opinion. You know, for example, in the case of the navigable waterway in South Carolina, I know roughly where they were talking about, and once I saw the video, I saw that it is obviously navigable. But the landowners were trying to claim that it was too dangerous to be navigable. And so they had to show a video of experienced paddlers safely navigating the rapids. Turns out it didn't kill them. They showed it in court of law. The judge had to conclude that it was, based on video evidence, a navigable waterway. And then finally, these very same groups see that these laws are enforced. Because occasionally, people will try to break laws, and someone needs to make the government aware that these laws are being broken. You know, for example, let's say that in Balsam Grove, North Carolina, there is a fish hatchery. There is. And let's say that when it floods, the chemicals used in that hatchery are not properly contained, ergo floodwaters can mix those chemicals with the groundwater, making the groundwater even more dangerous than it already is, killing livestock, which has happened. I've seen people witness that, and I've seen them try to report that. The problem is, when my friend tried to report that incident, nothing got done. Because by themselves, they only represented one person. Even though the law was on the books that you're not supposed to store chemicals that way, because it was just one person going up against a business with a lot of resources and backing, they weren't able to get anything accomplished. And so instead, my friend contacted a local environmental interest group who was fighting that case on their behalf. And so interest groups obviously serve a purpose. Can serve a positive purpose, but can also, like you read in the previous article, cause some problems. Now, how do they pull this off? If we want to get that fish hatchery to clean up their act, how do we actually make that happen? That's the really tricky part, and that's where lots of money is spent. So interest groups use a couple of different tactics that are fairly obvious and some less so. For example, direct mail. You know, the first proper step is to send a notarized letter to the proper channel. The interest group is going to know who that is, how to write that letter, and how to get it sent. To use advertising, maybe the public need to be made aware of this. You know, maybe the incident with the fish hatchery was only known to that one individual and only known to the judge that it was brought to. And had they left it be there, nothing's going to be done. And so maybe the public need to be aware of what's going on. Maybe there even needs to be a public event. You know, if the judge was acting unlawfully by siding with the fish hatchery, then the judge is in the wrong. And the public need to be made aware that our court system is not enforcing the laws appropriately. Now, interest groups use a variety of techniques to influence public opinion and policy. Perhaps the one that we recognize most often is the use of propaganda. We are exposed to propaganda in many different forms every day. And hopefully we are all educated enough to recognize when we are being exposed to propaganda and how to avoid being misled by biased information. Because after all, if the legal process does not work, if the judge is not going to change his mind through appropriate channels, the next step is for them to get the public riled up. You know, no president wanted to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act, one of the most significant pieces of federal legislation in American history. No president wanted to touch it from the 1800s until 1964. But you know what happened? 1 million people showed up in front of the White House and said, sign this thing. And they represented many more millions of people. And guess what? The president signed it. I mean, the NAACP had been working for over 50 years at that point to get that law signed. And 50 years of going through every appropriate channel they could think of. And finally, they went to the American people. And it got done. And so there are positive forms of this, just like there are negative forms of this. Okay, so how do we regulate this? You know, as I've demonstrated, like the NAACP, interest groups have done some amazing things in this country. But they've also hindered the democratic process in other ways, like you saw in the video. And so most people agree that there need to be rules placed on these types of groups, like limits on what they can contribute, or even a requirement to disclose money given. Did you know that many lawmakers retire and become lobbyists? It's one of the most common things for lawmakers to retire and then become lobbyists. And they're perfect for the job because they already know the other lawmakers. They already have dirt on them and they have long-standing relationships. They're the perfect people to try to get to influence their former colleagues. That is happening so much, and so many of these lawmakers retire and become lobbyists and make lots and lots and lots of money, that there are now regulations. As you saw in the article, they were originally only required to wait 1 year before they could become a lobbyist. Now they have to wait 2. There is a lot of controversy surrounding these interest groups and how they get things done. And that's the big problem that we've been talking about.